Well, good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. It's Wednesday, the 19th of November, and we welcome you. We're glad you're with us. We have a show today. It's a show. I said yesterday on paper it looked like it was going to be a great show. It wasn't really. So it looked good, but I couldn't muster, I guess, the necessary requirements to pull it off. Well, I'll try again today, but I'm not going to promise it's going to be a great show. So we'll give that a shot and see what happens. We have a wonderful group of panelists. They certainly will help the effort here, and we are thrilled to have them. Let me introduce them to you. A reminder, you are always a part of the show. If you write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz joins us. Good morning, Roger.
Welcome. Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Very nice to have you back. Thank you very much. We also welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin is here. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. So I got an interesting one for you today.
Oh, good.
Today is World Toilet Day. and we're going to laugh about it because it's sort of fitting for a lot of the topics that we're going to discuss.
Yeah.
However, there's a serious note to this. I want people just to take a second and think about things we take for granted, things like sanitation, public health, potable water. And as we go into our discussions today and we start to think about issues of like the role of government and common good, remember that we take a lot of things for granted, like the fact that you actually have a toilet that you can go to and use. So celebrate the humble toilet today with me.
You are Mr. Preparedness.
I am.
You are, man. That is that's good. Yeah. I was amused by the fact that one of the perks apparently that Ghislaine Maxwell has in prison is unlimited toilet paper. Did you see that?
I did not.
Yeah, unlimited toilet paper.
Should we have assumed limitation?
I don't know. I don't know, but I don't know, like, those of us on the outside of prison pretty much have unlimited, well, unless you can't get down the aisle to buy it. But other than
right,
that,
yeah.
But yes, you pretty much have, you can get, pay for it and all that. But anyway, I'll put those two things together,
yes.
Bundle them, as it were. Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan is with us. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. I don't think I have any trivia, but it's good to know today is, was it National, International Toilet
World,
Day?
It's
World Toilet Day. You know, I am very grateful for the toilet. I peed outside for the very first time in my life.
The show is already better than yesterday.
Wow.
Already. We have already cleared the bar.
Notify the folks at the Peabody Committee. Go ahead.
It was the first time ever in July. I was doing field work in Peru, and I was in the Sacred Valley with a bunch of shamans, and I had to. So,
yeah, you didn't really have a choice, do you?
Didn't really have a choice. And
yeah.
So I'm especially grateful, Bob.
And for unlimited toilet paper.
And maybe. For unlimited
toilet paper. Maybe that's the problem with the people out on Central Avenue. There's too many shamans out there.
Yes. In the slightly less sacred valley.
Right. Yes, that's a good point. Well, good morning, all. We welcome you and... panel@wamc.org if you'd like to join us, panel@wamc.org. All right. So yesterday all the fuss in Washington was about the Epstein files. We've talked about it on this program. It's hard not to. It is something that has gripped Washington and has caused a kerfuffle, a flurry, if you will. And I think it's a story that generally for a lot of us is still doesn't make complete sense where we're trying to figure it out and what it all means. But So Congress will send a bill to Trump to force disclosure of the Jeffrey Epstein files. The House overcame a months-long impasse, and the Senate moved quickly to dispatch with the issue. The vote was near unanimous, and so now it goes to Donald Trump for him to vote on. What I do think is interesting about this is the question of where will it go from here, and then ultimately what happens to it. The article this morning in the Washington Post says, despite congressional action, quick release of Epstein files is in doubt. The legislation calling for the release of Justice Department files in Jeffrey Epstein includes major loopholes. The department has been silent on its plans. The Justice Department has remained silent. And for the past week, official Washington has talked constantly about the Jeffrey Epstein investigation, except for the agency that actually has custody of the Epstein files. On Tuesday, the House and Senate agreed to pass a bill calling on Attorney General Pam Bondi to release all unclassified information and files related to the sprawling sex trafficking investigation into the one-time powerful financier. Now, you will remember that at the beginning of this year, right after the inauguration, Pam Bondi said, I have the files. They're on my desk. I'm ready to let them go. And that didn't happen. And then 11 months went by, and here we are again with the unclassified the information.
But Joe, there was also an important point in between that where Kash Patel, who's the FBI director, said there's nothing to see here.
Correct.
So
correct.
There's very, very mixed messages.
So the Justice Department so far has continued to say nothing about how it would respond to the demand. There are many reasons to doubt that a bulk release of the files is imminent. If President Trump wanted Bondi to release all of the Epstein files, he could have ordered her to do so at any point in the past 6 months. But he didn't. On Tuesday, when Trump did an about-face and said House Republicans should vote in favor of releasing Epstein files, he notably did not say he favored releasing them. Instead, he said in a social media post that the House can have whatever they are legally entitled to. I don't care. What Congress is legally entitled to is a more complicated question than the rhetoric from Capitol Hill might imply. The legislation that Congress agreed to pass Tuesday gives the Justice Department a few exceptions under which it can refuse to release material. Among them, if release would, quote, jeopardize an active federal investigation or ongoing prosecution. On Friday, Trump ordered Bondi to launch a new federal investigation related to Epstein. This one aimed at his ties to several prominent Democrats, including former President Bill Clinton, mega donor Reid Hoffman, and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. Bondi said the top federal prosecutors in New York would take on the task. I think I read yesterday that it took Pam Bondi 211 minutes to comply with the president's order to launch an investigation into the Democrats.
It's getting slow.
That investigation could become a reason for the Justice Department to block release of many files. Bonnie and her deputies have previously said they cannot release information about active investigations. Other information could be covered by grand jury secrecy rules. The bill Congress agreed to pass does not explicitly waive those. So the question I have for the panel this morning is, what was achieved here? What do we actually have? And once, if we even get the information, then what happens? I asked that question as well because I'm still unsure about that. Obviously, it depends what's in the files. But it does seem there is a reason that they're being withheld. And we don't know what that is. We can assume we don't know. And also that there are these investigations that have, in some cases, have just begun. And it seems, and I guess this is what I don't understand, that this will then continue to dog the president for dot, 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 how long? And we're right back where we were before.
Well, he's waiting. When he agreed to let it go to a vote or say he didn't care, you know, he's definitely counting on the Justice Department to not release the files, right? Then he can come across as being transparent, saying, well, I said it was okay for it to go to a vote. It's the Justice Department that is refusing to release the files because he has set up this new investigation, which will give him relatively external reason for why they're not going to release the files. But he can only kick this can down the road for so long. This is one of those issues that his MAGA base is holding on to. And I don't think he can push this so far down the road that people forget about it or lose interest. I mean, the longer he puts it off, the more suspicious people are becoming. And the little bits that are coming out from, like, the emails and the birthday cards earlier in the summer, all of these things are stacking up to paint a, you know, it's painting a pretty negative picture here. So the MAGA base is not going to let this one go if he thinks that's what's happening. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a few things to say. One is, I don't think there's going to be much of a blowback. I don't know how much is going to be released. I think there's a few things that we can expect. One is, if they do, whatever they do release, it has to be searchable online, right, in some sort of database. And it's just going to feed more and more conspiracy theories as people search things and figure out whose names might have been blacked out and whose names aren't blacked out. And there will be people hurt by it. I don't think it will be Trump, but probably some of his class and his donors and maybe even some friends. The one positive I see in this is that you have to something, you know, it's sad that this is where it happened, but this is the first instance really of the House and the Congress standing up to the president in this administration. There's been a sort of incredible chokehold that the president has had on his party. And four Republicans broke that hold. One is Tom Massey, who has acted, I think, largely out of principle for the year that Trump has been in power. And as a result, Trump has been coming after him and trying to fund a primary attack against him. But then the three Republican MAGA women, right? Green, Boebert, and Mace, none of whom are, you know, people that many of us think of as paragons of courage. And yet they've shown enormous courage standing up to the president in this particular instance, and more so than any of the sort of more established Republican moderate people who have completely caved over and over again. And I think that their courage, along with Massey, in standing up to the president on this issue, could, and I think might, especially given what happened in the elections a couple weeks ago, begin the easing of the stranglehold that President Trump has on the Republican Party. I mean, maybe that's too optimistic, but that would be the hopeful reading of this.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, and I appreciate the both sets of comments. What comes at one, I think there's a couple of framing thoughts. One, 427-1. Only one member of either the House or the Senate voted against this, and that was Clay Higgins from Louisiana, who, if you haven't watched Representative Higgins, I urge you to go on YouTube to see Special Type of Crazy. I found the Senate vote to be really interesting, a very interesting maneuver for Schumer to request unanimous consent and then to get it, because it allowed everybody not to have to actually go on the record, but at the same time moving it forward. At a higher level, Joe, I view the Epstein situation as a light onto some of the dark side of our systems. It continues to show the degraded nature of power dynamics in our country, and I think it shows some huge gaps in the myth of equality and justice for all, and that's why it continues to be an important story for me. I think this is going to dog Trump. It's going to dog his legacy. I mean, honestly, this is as much about his legacy as anything else is going to be, and he deserves it. I really think that's important.
So hear me out here, just as I try to work through this in my brain, I wonder. I mean, obviously, there's the hubris that the president often displays, but if there were nothing there, he has certainly weathered stronger storms. So the fact that that these obstacles have been put in place just naturally, whether it's true or not, has naturally put skepticism into the picture. And I just don't, you know, you're only sort of left with thinking one thing, right? That there's something really bad in there that they don't want us to see.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's the famous line in the Pink Floyd song Mother about, you know, Mother, should I trust the government? And the question to me has always been absolutely not. And it's confirmed in this situation that I do think that the records are going to be sanitized. I do think that the request for ongoing investigations was to be able to hide files. Mm-hmm. I will also say that having watched this week about the tranche of information that was released from the Epstein files, a lot of the emails and whatnot, shows some really bad stuff. And I think if that's being released, and this is the sanitized stuff, then I can only imagine how truly deplorable the other information is going to be. Now, whether I see that or not, I'm not sure.
We're going to take a break when we come back. We'll be back in just a second. We'll take a break, and when we return, we'll continue with this conversation. We have listener letters as well, and I want to get to those. You can add yours to the pile, panel at WAMC.org.
Be your own boss for the summer. Seize the moment before it's gone. 16 on a fishing.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So nice to have you with us. And let us go back to the conversation in discussing the Epstein files and the House and Senate moving this to the president's desk for him to approve that these files can be released. But then the bigger question as to just how many will be released by the Justice Department because of investigations already underway. Roger, you wanted to make a point right before the break.
Oh, well, again, I just don't. I am somewhat skeptical that you're going to see much information. I think a lot of it will be redacted and highlighted. You know, in the sense that you'll have some information, but it will be partial. I do worry that once you release, you know, I don't know how many thousands of pages with redactions, you're going to then see a whole bunch of amateur, you know, sleuths going through it and developing conspiracy theories around it and bringing people's names in who were maybe witnesses or who were, you know, mentioned, but for, you know, who knows what. Again, you never know what's going to happen. But the way our media works and the way social media works, to me, there could be an unintended and pretty unwelcome kind of blowback from this. That said, I do think there is a need for transparency in a case like this. And I do fear, however, that the investigations aspect will tie a lot of this up in darkness for a long time, and that we'll end up spending time on us conspiracy theories and not actually bringing the people who actually did something to light.
Well,
justice.
There are conspiracy theories circling right now because we don't have, you know, yeah, transparency, and we don't have enough information. And I think I would rather be inundated with all the data and the messiness and have it right out and open rather than, you know, keep things in the dark and continue this speculation. And really, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's been really annoying with this process is that there's so much speculation and conspiracy theories circling around. And I would say that's incredibly harmful, right? And we should, you know, the American people and the victims are entitled to truth and justice. I want to build on what Bob said earlier. I think we are facing a significant moment of a moment of reckoning, I guess, a moment of reckoning. This is a case that highlights the control of elites in our society. Right. The fact that these files have not been released and so many names are being protected. You know, we're dealing with a case in which there were over 1,000 victims. Right. And some of these people were as young as 14. That's absolutely heinous. And this is a scheme in which many elites are involved. And so that's why, you know, we don't have the files out in the open, right? If it involved, you know, regular people, we would know. But they're being protected. And I think that it's coming at a moment where the American people are especially frustrated with the inequality that they're seeing in our country. I mean, just through the shutdown and right now, you know, later we're going to maybe talk about the tariffs. Like, you know, affordability is a huge issue. Like, people are struggling to maintain their livelihoods. And here you see these big, rich, powerful men being protected after committing these terrible crimes against a vulnerable population, against children. So this is more than I think this case is poking at something that is much larger than just the Epstein files. It's pointing to a lot of this country's frustration with how you have this small group of people at the top who can get away with just about anything without consequence, and the rest of the country is really struggling.
And I hope that, you know, what do I hope comes out of this? What I hope is that at some point we have a Congress and a president who will actually sign new legislation dealing with human trafficking and the exploitation of children that will allow us to actually update our laws and our approach to handling gender and age and money and power and elites and wannabe elites. I don't think we have that Congress right now, and we certainly don't have that president right now. The other elements of this is that it continues to shine a bright light and forcing people to come public with some really inconvenient truths. I'm thinking about Megyn Kelly's comments, sort of trying to defend this whole activity as well. I mean, the girls were 15. It's not like they were 8. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding. I mean, she has a daughter who's 14. Could you imagine if this happened to your daughter? But again, it shows a moral corruption that certainly goes beyond just this country, but is in parts of society that I think we as a people need to begin to address. And the only way we can address it is by shining a light on it, because they do have the resources to cover up, and we've seen that. That's what this has been all the way along. This has been a cover up from the minute it's broke.
A lot's been made about the Megyn Kelly, but did you see the clip of Alan Dershowitz? Mm-hmm. Alan Dershowitz says, look, This young woman in this particular case, and what case that was, I don't remember, was 17 years old and 10 months. Come on. I shudder.
I do. And Alan Dershowitz is neck deep in the Epstein files. Yeah. This is the problem. When you start to look at the connectivity between some of these people and some of these organizations, it's a festering sore.
Mm-hmm. And the path forward is not lowering the bar and compromising our morality, right?
Right. We have a lot of letters. Let me get to some of them before we take a break. It doesn't matter what is or isn't in the Epstein file, says Tim. Honest images of Trump engaging in horrible acts would not harm him. Why? It's exactly what we expect of him. The entire story is a smokescreen. This doesn't excuse the issue, of course, but the aftermath will be forgotten in two or three news cycles. Russ?
Yeah, I mean, I understand what he's saying, but this thing has had a different set of legs for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. That it was viewed as a partisan whip. And what's sort of in my position is that this isn't about Republicans or Democrats. This is about the rich and elite and powerful. And that's what this really is about. This
on
is
the protection of children.
This is about the exploitation of children by powerful powerful men, regardless of their supposed political beliefs. This is grim. This is really grim.
And this is what I was saying earlier. When you look at of all the things that Trump has weathered and has said, well, I don't care, and has suffered whatever consequences there were, if anything, this one he seems to care about, which, again, just makes you wonder what's there more mm-hmm. more so than in other cases.
It is. But I'm taking this up just a little bit, but it also raises significant questions in my mind about where this country is as far as how we approach children. And I'm thinking also of like what Florida did with changing the laws allowing minors to work overnight and then expected to go to school. I mean, there's so many issues of class and how we're creating a permanent underclass in these stories. We can't lose sight of that fact. The power differential and the class issues and the fact that the laws aren't in place to protect children are something we can't lose sight of.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Bob, because, you know, after... Well, with the child labor laws loosening in Texas, with this, with Sandy Hook, like there is a clear long history, but also more recently of the U.S. devaluing children, right? A vulnerable population. And even though you have, you know, these people on the, you know, people on the right and tech bros saying, oh, we should really support fertility and reproduction in this country and have more children, they're not giving the American people a good case for having kids, right? It's like, okay, yeah, go ahead. We, you know, we're suffering from a dropping birth rate issue. But then you see what's going on. It's like, well, once the kids are here, what are you doing for them, right? This is not the kind of environment that is encouraging for prospective parents.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more letters on this, and then we'll move on to other topics. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org is where you can write your note. Panel at WAMC.org will return right after this. And the next thing you learn is how cold it can get at night. The music is from the Mountain Goats. They have a new album, a concept album called Through This Fire Across Peter Balkan. And the playlist posted on our website, WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org/roundtable. Roger Berkowitz is here. Bob Griffin is here. So is Catherine Tan. And for the sake of this conversation, just call me Piggy.
That was so uncomfortable. I think you need to tell people the story, though. So that they...
No, I just want people to call me. the president on Air Force One. The president had a twofer yesterday. Well, over the last 2 days, there was one on Air Force One, in which a reporter was there asking questions, and he said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Quiet, Piggy, quiet."
Yeah.
And yelled at her, and then he berated an ABC reporter, a woman, who was asking questions about the Epstein files and got
Khashoggi.
Personal. Yeah.
And his family finances, doing exactly what a free press should do.
Yes. And again, fake news and so forth. So it is you can readily find those online. But there we go. Let's go to the letters. John writes to us and says, are you kidding? You think this Epstein Association will destroy Trump's legacy? What planet are you all on? If his actions surrounding January 6th didn't, this won't either. Further, the MAGA support for getting Epstein file information is strictly related to implicating Democrats, period. And Trump has now set that up perfectly with his scam investigation.
I don't think this is going to hurt Trump, and I don't know what it's going to do to his legacy. I mean, I don't think it's going to do much. And I think that many of the people implicated in this will be Democrats, because I think Epstein traveled in largely Democratic circles. But I do think there's something important about this story, which is that it has mobilized the movement, and a movement that's beyond the MAGA movement. It's also the sort of more populist movement on the left, against the corruption of an elite politics, and that I think will not end easily. Where it goes and whether it stays MAGA and Democrat separated or where they somehow combine, I don't know. But I think there is. I think what you see is that Trump has been able to hold a wide-ranging movement together for about 10 years, and he's losing control of some of it. And politically, that matters. I don't think we yet know where it's going to go, but I don't think it's a non-event.
Liz writes to us and says, aren't there various copies of the Epstein files where we'd be able to cross-check what is released? If not, this is all for naught, because they will sanitize them. This keeps me up at night, says Liz. Then we go to...
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely the concern and conspiracy, and I would say this also leads to the continued malaise in the country about lack of faith in our institutions. I find it impossible to look at this current DOJ and the DOJ leadership and say that they're playing anything straight. At the same time, there is information out, and more information will come out, and I would also probably believe that they've been working to retract and hide information, but enough information gets out.
Doug says, I'm so tired of this. We're talking about the biggest human trafficking case in modern times. Why is this political? Children were and probably are being raped and assaulted on a regular basis, and the great US of A isn't doing jack squat about it except debate it at our Capitol. It's sad, and it makes me sick. That from Doug. We got this from Kay. Why does the president who has usurped every congressional and constitutional power possible during his time in office have to wait for congressional approval to release files that a cabinet office that reports to him is holding? It is hypocrisy at its finest. Yes,
he just doesn't like to lose. He knew he was going to lose, so he says he's on the winning side. It's scary, though, Joe. I'm not sure this is the biggest. You know, the other letter writer talked about it as being the biggest sexual abuse scandal. I don't think it is. I think the problem of sex trafficking and child abuse is a much bigger problem.
Well, that's how I took that letter, meaning that it is one of our largest problems, and yet we've reduced it to this.
It is. I will agree with that. I also think that very rarely do we get an insight into the inner workings of the elite worlds, the elite worlds that involve apparently prime ministers of the UK, certainly former princes, our own political leadership. And again, I've said it before, I will continue to say, this is not, in my mind, a partisan issue. This is a power and elite issue. And as far as where I stand is that I don't care who you are. If you are involved in this, you should be tried and convicted and put away regardless of your age.
Morgan writes to us and says, even if there is indeed a bulk file dump, which is doubtful, how certain could we possibly be those files wouldn't be altered, redacted beyond any possible value? Per usual, this appears one more situation where Trump's obfuscation and obstruction will only delay actually finding out the truth of all the crimes committed by hundreds or possibly thousands of wealthy, powerful politicians, financiers, and industry heads. Anyway, there are reasons why the American people have so little trust in any of the three branches of government. This is but one example. Then we go to Joanne. How long have Justice and the FBI had the files? Don't you think that any mention of 47 will be cut and replaced by the names of Democrats? In any case, he'll get away with it the way he always has.
So what do we do then, Joe? Do we just not pay attention to it? Because
I was going to go in a slightly different direction. Okay. It's also important to realize that the Biden Justice Department had these files as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do anything with them. And there's a new book out called Injustice by Carol Lenig and her reporting partner. They're both Pulitzer Prize winners, and the gentleman's name is escaping me. Aaron. I want to say Davis, but I'm not positive that that's it. Anyway, in the book, it just came out, and it's fascinating. But it's about the investigation, the Merrick Garland investigation into January 6th, and just how they were trying to be legal,
yep.
and I would argue even polite. And waiting, and meanwhile, they lose 17 months, they start the investigation late, and then they just fritter it away. So I have no guarantee that that isn't exactly what happened in this particular case with those files on the desk of Merrick Garland or others in the Justice Department.
I think Merrick Garland is going to go down in history as a very, very flawed man and responsible for a lot of the issues because he did not act well. I also think that he was the wrong choice for Attorney General. I mean, I remember saying it from the very beginning. I would have actually urged Biden to have put someone like Cuomo in as the Attorney General at the time, somebody who was going to be more aggressive. He was more concerned about the perception of politics than he was about justice. And he allowed Trump to do what Trump has done his entire career, and that was use the justice system to run the clock. And he does own, I think, a lot of the responsibilities for the mess after January 6th, and for the whole Epstein thing. And I also think there was a general feeling among some of the elites that when Epstein was buried. That the problem has gone away, and that we can just move on because it's easier to ignore the victims than it is to deal with some of the other players that were involved in the situation.
Russ writes, the vote to release the Epstein files is obviously meaningless. The Justice Department is now an arm of the executive regime and is charged with supporting the president. Any references to the president will have been scrubbed by the sources of FBI new hires tasked with protecting the presidency in their review of those files. That from Russ. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And so, you know, I was just thinking about all the time that has been spent over the last several weeks, and we're at this point. And again, I don't think we're any further than we were before, other than you could argue, I guess, that there's perhaps greater skepticism, but even if not, there is greater focus. But the vote I find interesting because it tells you everything, doesn't it? You can be on the right side of yes, these should be released, knowing that nothing is going to happen.
there's certain theatrical performativeness about this. There's no doubt. In fact, you know, it's although on the show in the past we've asked, well, what could possibly bring Congress back together again, because they seem to be so divided, and we did find an issue that they apparently feel is too hot for even their stupid politics, except I would note that the Speaker pretty much put the House out of session for 2 months, I think more because of this issue than anything to do with finances. So it does show that there are issues that we may have commonality. So that's not insignificant. Roger, I thought your points were spot on about people who I didn't expect to show any moral courage, because I didn't believe they had a moral bone in their body, showing more moral courage than I thought a lot of others did.
But the bar is on the ground. No, it's subterranean. The bar is subterranean here. Like, who is going to come out and say, I don't want transparency on this case of abuse of minors? Like,
well, most of Congress was until four Republicans stood up against them. Now, you're right, the bar is low, but what's been shocking over the last 10 years is how well-established, normally, you know, thoughtful and well-regarded moderate Republicans have sunk below the subterranean bar you're talking about. And what is amazing is that four Republicans, Tom Massie and the three women, you know, Marjorie Greene, Nancy Mace, and Laura Boebert, and I give their names not because I like them, because I don't really like their politics at all or who they've been, but they deserve credit here. I mean, they stood on a principle that I think one that may, and it also is important to remind us. I mean, people have been going on and on how about Trump is totalitarian or Trump is a tyrant. I mean, this shows what standing up to people is possible, and they did it. And it was none of the – it wasn't Johnson. It wasn't any of the Republican leaders. It was these,
I totally agree. No, I think it does take bravery. But at the same time, with so many others not stepping up with these four, I find that really just beyond disappointing and shocking. And
I mean, it's worth noting, right? I think you're right. Laura Boebert was apparently called into the Situation Room in the White House.
Yes.
I mean, I just heard this morning, so I don't know exactly what this means, but they tried a last-minute attempt to get her to, you know, take her name off the petition. I mean, first of all, that's an enormous amount of pressure to put on somebody, to bring them into the Situation Room one-on-one and have a conversation and tell them, you know, and she held firm. And again, I'm not trying to, like, hold her up as a paragon of virtue, because I don't think she is. But I do give her credit, and I think credit should be given in this case.
Yeah, and one quick comment. You know, don't forget, there was a special election in Arizona that flipped. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't for those three, they wouldn't have stampeded the cockroaches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They would have, if any one of those three had backed out, they would not have voted. That the vote would not have come to the floor, and it would have been business as usual. Think about how sick that is.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's horrible.
We'll take a break. And don't worry, there's more horrible stuff to talk about, and we'll do exactly that.
On National Toilet Day.
Right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is 9 minutes past 10 o'clock. Roger Berkowitz is here. So is Robert Griffin and Catherine Tan. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. President Donald Trump on Tuesday defended Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the killing of Washington Post opinion columnist Jamal Khashoggi, saying, quote, things happen. And then he did not hold the Saudi leader responsible for the 2018 murder, despite a U.S. intelligence report assessing the opposite. Trump's dismissive language offered the highest level confirmation yet that Mohammed will face few consequences for the killing, as the Crown Prince makes his first visit to Washington since Khashoggi was dismembered in a Saudi consulate in Turkey. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or you didn't, things happen. But Muhammad knew nothing about it, Trump said in a response to a question about Khashoggi. And we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guests by asking a question like that.
He embarrassed Zelensky. That was no problem.
You know. Straws. Muhammad arrived to grand welcome from Trump at the White House on Tuesday, greeted at the South Portico with an army honor guard of black horses and herald trumpeters, a remarkable turnaround for the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, who has been branded a pariah in 2018 after the CIA concluded that he had approved the killing of Khashoggi. It was a military aircraft flyover on Tuesday to welcome Muhammad to the White House. Jason.
All of the trappings of an insecure dictator, Joe.
Yes. Yes. The Washington Post director of press freedom said pariahs shouldn't get to visit the White House. It's a mistake to reward the most abhorrent abuses of power. As early as his first term, Trump declared his desire to move past the killing and protect Muhammad from congressional demands for consequences.
Well, none of this is surprising, right? Trump loves an authoritarian leader. He fancies himself an authoritarian leader. He has money tied up in Saudi Arabia, and he himself is quite hostile towards the press, which, you know, with the piggy comments that we discussed earlier. And, you know, I'm not, you know, the interaction and the way he warmly welcomed MBS is not all that surprising. And the fact that he was so dismissive of Khashoggi's killing is really abhorrent, especially when we know that, you know, he has proven himself to be incredibly hostile towards the free press, right? He was it just yesterday he said that he was threatening to rescind the broadcasting licenses used by the affiliates of ABC. He said that it should be taken away because of a question that a reporter had asked him from that network. And, you know, it was about the Epstein files. Earlier in the summer, he went after Kimmel and Colbert. He had cut over $1 billion to public broadcasting for NPR, PBS. He cut funding to Voices of America. So Trump has a long history of going after the press, especially when they say things that he does not like or approve of. But it's, yeah, I mean, his comments were really heinous, but in line with his general flavor of aggression.
Roger.
I think it's important to recognize that you can, on the one hand, morally condemn the killing of Khashoggi, right, which one should. And yet, understand that there are other foreign policy implications too. I mean, the U.S., let's remember, doesn't have clean hands here around the world. We've killed U.S. citizens like Anwar Awlaki. Mm-hmm. We've killed people like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. We foreign policy often has very dirty hands. I'm not defending it per se at all, but I think the way Trump. As often with Trump, I mean, the way he speaks is just so abhorrent and so boorish that it's embarrassing and hard to take. All I want to say is that Saudi Arabia, you know, Joe Biden also went and fist bumped, MBS, because Saudi Arabia plays an important role in the Middle East. And as much as, you know, we can dislike Trump's method and approach, he is moving towards peace in the Middle East in a way that very few presidents have ever been able to accomplish. Whether it will happen or not, I don't know. But the UN resolution the other day to call for, you know, a peace plan in the Middle East is an accomplishment, and one should at least give some credit where credit is due. And Saudi Arabia is playing an enormous role there. Obviously, there's not full buy-in yet. They still insist on a two-state solution, and Israel is against that, and so there's a There's a divide. But Saudi Arabia is playing a constructive role in trying to create a midway through this peace process. And I think we shouldn't ignore that, and Trump should be given some credit for trying to build that relationship and allow that to happen. That said, I don't think to do that, you need to be completely boorish. You don't need to be calling reporters piggy or saying fake news. You don't need to be saying, you know, that guy, you know, maybe some people didn't like him or not. I mean, look, Khashoggi, whether you like him or not, you shouldn't be killing citizens and you shouldn't be killing innocent people. And he should be able to say that and yet also make the case for a foreign policy realism that I also believe is something to be structurally supported.
The couple of other points, though. The reporter in question from ABC actually asked two questions, if I remember correctly. The first question was to Trump about concerns that his family is financially involved with the Saudi royal family, which he always bristles at. But there's plenty of information out there saying that is exactly what the case is that Kushner and Junior are both neck deep with the Saudi royal family. And again, I think this goes back to part of the earlier conversation we have about the lack of faith in where our foreign policy is, because it's so intertwined with Trump's own personal finances. Roger, you're absolutely right. The dilemma the United States has is that it has been allied with Saudi Arabia, but the Khashoggi piece is just one element of it, right? I mean, there's a whole issue of 9/11. There's a whole issue of what is being taught in the royal family approved curricula of the school system that is anathema to and anti-American. I mean, this is a country, if you really looked at it on its face, we shouldn't be treating as a trusted friend. This is a government and philosophy that runs contrary to what we believe as core values in this country. It also comes back to, and I'm sorry to continue to talk about class and elites. Class and elites and oil and money and forgiving continued bad behavior because of all of those influences. What's also interesting, Joe, that after the sort of tense back and forth with reporters that evening, that the Crown Prince and the President and his children had dinner with a bunch of tech CEOs. They did, and again,
Elon Musk, who made a first return to the White House,
a triumphant return. It's just too bad we didn't have the Home Depot ballroom ready for the event. But again, I think there's. I mean, there's connectivity between a lot of these issues, and you see the same names, you see the same people, and for us, like, what does this mean for the rest of us in this country and what we believe in, and what do we do about it?
Yeah, the concentration of power at the top and how it intersects, or not even intersects, but how politics and business and money. All these things are intertwined. Like you can't really separate them. And you know, it's moments like this visit, MBS's visit, that gives you a glimpse into that world, right? It's you know, we're outraged because you shouldn't be murdering journalists, right? As you point out, Roger, we've also as a country have been guilty of similar crimes, right? But you know, that's beneath that outrage, that initial outrage, is what you're pointing out, Bob, is that these problems are deeply rooted in a much larger fundamental issue about the concentration of power and the lack of transparency.
Yeah. And I think it is, as Roger, you know, you might want to talk a little bit more about sort of the intertwining of politics and even religion. right? Mm. That the Saudis are sort of a counterbalance to Iran. The expectation, though, of sale of advanced aircraft, military aircraft to the Saudis was supposedly predicated on recognition of Israel, which again hasn't happened, and now all of a sudden it's not just the tech bros that we're talking about, it's the Lockheed Martins and mm-hmm. the military industrial complex that's involved in this. So there's an awful lot that's interrelated mm-hmm. with this whole situation. But let's be honest, is that he's Trump has invited people to the White House, the people's White House, that don't believe in a lot of our core beliefs as a country. And what we can do about it is that we could try to put people in office, whether it's at local government or in Congress, that would say, no, that's not going to be acceptable.
When it comes down to it, I guess we look at the relationship, and I, this is where you started, Catherine, but there's no, I even said it in the in reading the introduction, there's no surprise here. This is where this has been the opinion for a long time. What you do the spidey senses start to say, okay, but is somebody going to look into the money that's being that's changing hands? And the president used this answer at least four times yesterday that I heard about how he has nothing to do with his family's business, and yet he is glad to see that they're doing extremely like boasting as a father that his sons are getting filthy rich.
He really can't help himself.
Yeah. No, no.
I mean, it's, you know, you have to remember that when he started this thing in 2015, 2016, one of his lines that was so popular was, I know how corrupt these guys are. I know how they don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. I know how this works. At least I'm honest about it, and I'll fight for you. I mean, he has this sense of, I could be corrupt because I'm telling you I'm corrupt. And I'm an honest, corrupt person in the Senate. I'm not trying to hide it. And this goes to what Bob was just saying. I think that's worked to the extent that, you know, he's turned the White House largely into a business proposition mm-hmm. for himself. I mean, he's made billions of dollars on cryptocurrency in the last 9 months in a shocking way and just extraordinary amount of money. Not to mention all the stuff in Saudi Arabia and other countries that he's working in, or and his sons are working in, and he sees that as proof of his, you know, prowess and not as something to be embarrassed by, and the way in which we've created this gold rush mentality where if you're not part of the, you know, corruption oiling the machine, you're missing out on a great amount of money. I mean, you've created a situation where people are no longer embarrassed about this. They're actually seeing it as proof that they're, you know, honest and open about what they're doing. And that is a culture change that he has brought to the White House and to the country that I think will last and will be a legacy of his for a long time. And that, to me, is one of the really horrifically sad parts of what's going on.
Well, this is what his base voted for, right? Like they like the idea that he was a ruthless, albeit oftentimes unsuccessful, but businessman, right? This is the person that they voted for.
That's
this is the image and the values that they supported. He represented an extreme delusional American dream, right? That really spoke to his base, that, you know, imagined that maybe one day, you know, delusionally, that they could achieve something like that too, that they could live in a country where you can accumulate this much wealth.
Yeah, and you know, go back to, you know, drain the swamp, but I think what we're seeing is that the swamp, he's quote, drained the swamp and replaced it with a septic field. It's I mean, it's so ugly. And Joe, there was an interesting article earlier this week about what the Swiss delegation brought I mean, it's like we have an emperor that people are bringing riches to, that they came among the gifts was a one of a kind Rolex watch,
a clock
for desk clock, but there was a gold bar
with
a gold bar with his face on it. I mean, that's not what this country is supposed to be about.
Yeah, it's important. You know, back in the debates over the Constitution, and Zephyr Teachout has written a lot about this. You know, one of the biggest worries that the people writing the Constitution had was around corruption. And they passed, and it was made clear that you couldn't accept gifts, you couldn't accept these kind of things, emoluments and things of this sort. And I think one of the, you know, and this is a more complicated story than one person good or one person bad, but I think what you've seen is the sense among people that the elites and the people running the White House of both parties over the last 40 or 50 years had become so corrupt and so indulgent of corruption, but not admitting it, that people see Trump's brash admission of it and embrace of it as a more honest and having more integrity than what he was replaced. I'm not sure that's right. I don't think it's right, but I think there's, because there is something to be said for hypocrisy, right? Because hypocrisy at least gives credence to the virtues that one holds, but there's a kind of attack on hypocrisy that Trump has stood behind and that his base has pushed that has destroyed even the sense of there are limits and ideals that we should pursue. I understand where it comes from, and I think it comes from an anti-elitist rage, and we can support the anti-elitist rage, but we have to understand that it's destroying even the fundamental ideas of hypocrisy or ideals that hypocrisy recognizes, and that's going to last a long time.
And when you layer on the Supreme Court's decision granting immunity, which, again, besides Citizens United, is probably one of the sickest decisions that we've seen in modern judicial rulings. They in that decision fundamentally changed the nature of this country, and there is a special place in heck for the justices that supported that position.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Lots more to discuss this morning, and we'll talk about the Texas congressional map being blocked. We'll talk about the Education Department plans. Those have come. The dismantling of the Education Department, and that's their word for it. And also, the president has promised lower food prices. What does that mean? So all kinds of good issues to jump into. We will do exactly that when we return. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll continue our conversation with our brilliant trio after this short break and news from BBC. Will you lie still while I reapply your... Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It is our panel discussion that we're having this morning, and we welcome you to join in. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's go to some new topics, as I mentioned before the break, and teased, hopefully successfully, as to what we'll talk about. The federal court has blocked Texas's Republican-friendly congressional map. The move dealt a blow to efforts by Texas Republicans and President Trump to flip Democratic seats in the state. Texas quickly filed a notice of appeal to the Supreme Court. The federal court in Texas on Tuesday blocked that the state's newly redrawn and Republican-friendly congressional map from going into effect. The panel of three federal judges in El Paso in a 2-1 decision sided with civil rights groups that had sued to invalidate the map, which was part of Texas's aggressive mid-decade push to draw new congressional boundaries at Mr. Trump's behest. The court orders that the 2026 congressional election in Texas shall proceed under the map that the Texas legislature enacted in 2021, the court said, issuing a preliminary injunction barring the map's use. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, who directed state legislators to redraw the congressional map this summer, quickly said the state would appeal the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state filed its notice of appeal later in the day yesterday.
Bob? So this is kind of a difficult one to talk about because it sort of has elements of dog catches bus.
That old tale.
And dog doesn't know what to do with the bus. In a perverse way, this may be one of the best things that could have happened to the Republicans in Texas, because I think there's an awful lot of buyer's remorse that has been going on when, as they've sort of dug into the districts and the redistricting that was done, and looking at some of the voting patterns that they saw come out of New Jersey and Virginia in the 2 weeks ago, I guess, election. So I think there's a lot of people who are questioning whether the redistricting was actually a smart idea or not. I will also say that not understanding all of the implications of the decision that came out of the court, I will toss a couple other issues that I am looking at as far as this story. One is, there's an interesting side story about Paxton and Paxton, who's the attorney general for the state of Texas, who's also running for the Senate, the U.S. Senate, in his desire to move this immediately to the Supreme Court to try to put himself in a more advantageous position as far as his political future. You also have Greg Abbott, who is running for a fourth term as governor. At a time when his popularity is at a historical low, so you have the story of Trump. You have the story of, at least in my mind, a fundamental change to how we think about the redistricting, changing sort of the rules of redistricting, which is we saw with the whole California situation. You also have Texas politics, and then you have an inter-GOP food fight between Paxton and the senior senator from Texas.
Cruz?
No, Corbin.
Corbin. John Corbin.
Corbin, yeah. Yeah, although I thought it was interesting that Cruz is also floating his desire to run for president again. So, I mean, that's good. I'd love a chance to vote against Ted Cruz. So there are all of these issues that are caught up in this story. Giving credit to Roger, because I'll steal your thunder and turn it right over to you. I'm not sure exactly what this means.
Yeah, I mean, this particular case, which will go to Judge Alito, Samuel Alito of the Supreme Court, as a question of a stay, we don't know, but will probably be stayed. At which point, until the Supreme Court decides it won't be the decision won't last in power. I don't know how quickly the Supreme Court will be able to decide it. I imagine not in time to affect the midterms. So I don't know what the result of this actual case is. There's one or two things to say. One is, I would like to agree with Bob, and I hope he's right, that there's a kind of Republicans, maybe breathing a sigh of relief. I mean, I think that I think there's no doubt that the Trump Republicans have overplayed their hands on a number of issues, on the deportations of people here without valid papers, but who were law-abiding, thoughtful, good citizens, including, you know, and people applying for asylum, like the Bard student who's been arrested and in detention now for over a month in New Jersey. I think the Trump administration has clearly overplayed its hands amongst independents and even some Republican voters. And I think gerrymandering is another issue where there's a lot of, you know, independent voters in this country who simply think this is not the way you go about doing politics. You know, I do think that, and I think to tie it back to the Epstein case, I mean, there is a growing sense that Trump is not going to be president forever, and that he's this undying loyalty to this wannabe tyrant was not a good idea. I'm not starry-eyed. I don't think it's all about to fall apart, but I think you're seeing slow resistances to it build. The one other thing I want to just mention about this decision, and this is just somewhat of a hobby horse of mine, is that, you know, I think the media is still unsure of how to report decisions like this and whether they should report what president appointed the judges. We, you know, those of us who read the stories, and I think Joe even mentioned this, that the judges who ruled against the Texas gerrymander, one was appointed by Trump and one was appointed by Obama, and the judge who dissented was appointed by Reagan. I mean, the whole premise of our legal system is that judges are supposed to, you know, be above that kind of partisanship. And for most of my life, you didn't report on who appointed a judge. I think there's a sense that now Trump demands unyielding loyalty. And as a result, we begin to do this. And I understand it. I know people want to hear it. And yet I think it is really... I think it does undermine the sense of judicial independence when we start doing that. I'm not say you shouldn't, because I know people want it and I know it matters. And yet I also think we have to be more careful about it. And I don't know. I don't have the right answer. I just point it out as something that worries me.
Taylor.
The big issue is voter disenfranchisement, right? All this talk about gerrymandering, all this redistricting. I think it's all stupid, and it's all really I think it's so stupid. I mean, why are we letting land vote, right? We need a better system to ensure equal representation, to ensure that people's interests from that everyone's interests is represented. But what this has shown is, you know, the system is so vulnerable to being manipulated in a way that drowns out minority voices, voices of the most disenfranchised. So for me, this is the big overarching issue, is what are we going to do so that we have, how can we remodel the system so that we actually have real representation for the people who live in these states? You know, what Texas has done, and, you know, I'm from California. I'm a Democrat. And what California did, saying, oh, well, Texas is going to do this, and then to counter that, well, if they redistrict, then we'll redistrict. The whole thing is just so ugly. I'm like, that's not a system. That's not a way. I don't want the system to work that way, right? I want us to have a system in place that actually represents the voters. I think the system, what we have right now, is so messy, and I don't even know how you move forward from this, right? How can we ensure that people's voices are heard and they're given equal representation? You know, and also with everything that's going on in Louisiana and the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, like, constantly we're seeing attacks on these structures and guardrails for representation.
Yeah, except the one thing that I'll give California credit for is that I think they did it the right way. They brought it to their voters, mm-hmm. and said, okay, the rules of the game have now changed,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and do we want to lose our voice in this, and the votes were overwhelming.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say that I thought it was going to win. I didn't think it was going to win by the margin that it did. So I also understand, or I don't understand. I think I appreciate some of California's frustration is that their population continues to be underrepresented, mm-hmm. given games that are mm-hmm. being played. And, you know, you think about the value of a vote in Wyoming versus the value of vote in California. But that gets to fundamental issues in the country. I mean, if I could write, you know, a humane and decent, you know, addendum to Project 2025, or one of the things that I'd love to see is a standardization of how districts are determined across the country, so that there's it's a fair and balanced process for every state.
Right.
And then we'll get into the questions of, oh, that's a state right. Well, it's, you know, I find it interesting that things that are considered a state right are only mm-hmm. when they don't like what you're saying to them.
Yeah, and you're right, like, California probably needs to be redistricted. But for it to come out as a retaliation, that was the part where I'm like,
yeah,
there has to be a different way about this.
We have a couple of letters here. This one from, from Barbara, who's asking the question, so now what does California do? And not the only state to deal with this, of course, as other states are pondering as well. And then we got a letter.
Joe, just to that, can I say?
Go ahead. I mean, yes, please.
In the original legislation, California had said that if Texas doesn't redistrict, they would not redistrict as well.
Right.
That got taken out at the last minute. And so California will have a decision to make, or actually, I don't know if they have a decision, or it just goes. They go ahead and redistrict whether or not Texas does.
Right. They have direction from the people of California that's mm-hmm. what the districts are going to be. That's what's going to happen.
So if Texas doesn't redistrict and California does, you actually see the redistricting potentially swing in the favor of the Democrats, although a number of other Republican states have also done smaller redistricting,
right.
And Virginia may also redistrict in favor of the Democrats as well.
GOP Doug caught the bus.
Yeah,
we'll take a break and come back and finish up our program. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel. And we are just finishing up. I have one or two topics to get to here before we go to the top of the hour. This is a story from the BBC, but I think it was succinct in its reporting of this, which is when President Donald Trump last week removed tariffs on more than 200 products, it represented something of a political earthquake and marked a significant concession on a hallmark White House policy. Deviating from the BBC story just for a moment, you'll remember that after Election Day, where Democrats did very well, the president said that we have this new word now that people are flocking to, and it's called affordability.
Hmm.
It's a new word, and it's called affordability, and
like,
that's
like groceries,
and that's what people are talking about, and on Monday, two days ago, Monday, said in the Oval Office that his administration has done more to impact affordability than any other president.
Well, that's true.
And I thought, well, that's an interesting way to put it now, mm-hmm. isn't it? Well, the president then last week removed tariffs on more than, this is what he was referring to, the removal of the tariffs. The decision, which critics said was long overdue, came as the president returned his attention to cost of living issues after polls suggested affordability concerns were weighing down White House approval ratings and hurting Republican candidates in recent elections. A top lobby group for the food industry, FMI, the Food Industry Association, I don't know where the M comes from, hailed the tariff rollback, which affected popular items like bananas and coffee, as a critical step toward affordability, as other business groups also praised the move. But in the end, the practical relief may not feel as monumental as the political gesture. In October, the budget lab at Yale projected that Trump's tariffs this year, currently a baseline tax of 10% on imports from all countries with additional levies on many trading partners, would drive up food prices almost 2% in the short term. The impact would be significant given that U.S. grocery prices historically have been relatively stable, rising an average of only 2% a year between 2013 and 2021. The White House order did not eliminate tariffs on all food, but it removed levies on some items such as coffee, spices, and tropical fruit like bananas, for which U.S. production is negligible or non-existent. For those kinds of goods, economists and businesses says they expected the order would bring down prices and relatively quickly. Of course, the big one that remains an issue is that of beef and beef prices.
But remember, the beef issue is also tied to the fact that illegal immigrants are apparently bringing cows with them, which is this was a statement from our Treasury Secretary.
Yes, Scott Bessent on Sunday.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, he made the comment linking illegal immigration and illegal immigrants bringing cows into the country. And there's some wonderful memes about people trying to throw cows over a wall. It's just it's worth seeing. Well, I'll also note though, Joe, that for people who follow, it's sort of a remarkable shift, because remember what Lutnick and the rest of the clown show were saying about tariffs is that the American people don't pay tariffs, that these foreign entities are going to pay tariffs. So the fact that they had to roll back tariffs because the prices on food were too high just goes to show you who is paying for tariffs. It's the people of this country. So, you know, we're talking about one of the largest tax increases on the population in many, many decades. It's also too late to have an impact on Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I will just note.
And this exemplifies how unsophisticated Trump's understanding of tariffs are, right? He believes that all of these tariffs are going to bring businesses back to the United States. Well, guess what? There are a lot of things that we can't produce. And business, living in a globalized world, companies and businesses and production, it's all interconnected. It's not like you can bring in these tariffs and expect all these businesses to stay in the United States or to develop in the United States. These things take years, and you can't just reverse it like that. And now the tariffs on food, well, okay, great. So we're going to save a couple of cents on bananas. But other tariffs will have a downstream impact on the cost of food. It's not just about the cost of bananas. It's all of the other components and actors that are involved in bringing, soybeans from Brazil to the United States. There are so many other elements that are in the middle there, right? And the things that he's doing to address affordability is just patching an old roof, right? It's not a real renovation. So, like, this is, to me, very similar to the 50-year mortgage. It's like, okay, great. What is that going to do, right? What is it going to do for people now? And is that even a sustainable solution, right? Like, reversing these tariffs here and there.
Well, not for the people who actually get a 50-year mortgage. Right. No, it is.
No, it's not sustainable. You know, but this is an example of that, right? Like, this is trying to put patches on the places where he thinks, there's a leak. But really, this is a systemic problem.
Just to put what Bob said into context, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent tried to explain high beef prices over the weekend by blaming undocumented immigrants, saying they were bringing sick cows into the United States. Mr. Bessent said that forced the Trump administration to halt imports of beef from Mexico, which is the second largest supplier of beef to the United States. Then to further show how caring the president is on this issue, he decided to visit a McDonald's summit in Washington on Monday to talk up his affordability agenda, coming as he's struggling with this major economic problem. With beef prices approaching $10 per pound, the Trump administration is scrambling to bring them down, including by lowering tariffs on beef imports and trying to address a shortage of cows. With many Americans frustrated that Mr. Trump's tariffs, his advisors have been straining to blame the high cost of hamburgers and anything else on anyone or anything other than the president of the United States, and that from the New York Times.
Is there a correlation between Trump going to the McDonald's thing and the return of the McBurglar?
No, but it does account for, if you go on over how many sold, those numbers changing. You watch them. It's fascinating. Roger.
I just think it's important to note the language of the new word that's been invented, affordability. It is changing the discourse of politics in our time, right? I mean, I think Trump in many ways came to power on cultural and other issues. I think the antidote is looking, first of all, we have to recognize that there is a complete split in our economy, though. The people earning over a certain amount of money have no affordability problems. They're doing quite well, and spending in that part of the economy is very high. But for a vast majority, and probably 70 or 80, 90% of the population, you know, the economy's not working for them very well. And eventually, cultural issues are going to fall by the wayside, and economy's going to come up. And that does seem to me where people are headed. And the Democratic, you know, wave in the last election clearly showed the appeal of that. And I think it's a good thing for the country that both parties start focusing on that.
Yeah, well, unaffordability is creeping up. Right. Yeah. You know, I think you're right. Like, cultural issues are going to start to matter less and less if people can't afford to pay for food and rent. And this is when I say it's creeping up, I mean, it's not, you know, it's impacting like college educated people who were promised a spot in the middle class, that were promised stability. And that's not getting delivered.
But it's also, I mean, I think this is also go back to the arrogance of the Biden administration saying that the economy is good when everybody was suffering. And people are suffering more, and we're hearing that the economy is good, and I don't want to hear about affordability. Trump learned nothing from Biden.
Good point. All right. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us. Very nice to have you all here and for sharing your insights and brilliance. I appreciate it. We will continue with the roundtable after this short break.